the heart of flyover country, this is Spin Sold Separately.
Sometimes I have to remind myself that our president, Donald Trump, is 78 years old and apparently never takes a day off, does press conferences on Air Force One, in the Oval Office, on the tarmac as he's waiting to get on Marine One, and I catch what I would call a moderate to somewhat intense cold, and I'm outside of my day job, basically on the shelf for 2 weeks. We are not all built the same. This guy is just built differently. We are over 3 weeks into this presidency. I'm not sure if he slept. I'm sure he has. You know, there's no video evidence of it anywhere. It's unbelievable the stamina this man has, especially knowing the resistance he's going to face at every turn from these legacy media clowns and the over-the-top Democrats who just can't help themselves, and they're going to live to regret it. But I'm getting way ahead of myself here. Thank you once again for joining me, everyone, for Spin Sold Separately. I am JD. A happy Valentine's Day to all of you who celebrate. My wife and I do not, and have not for many, many years. Not trying to be, you know, the wank, 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 but I don't know. I never researched Valentine's Day enough as to why it's a thing, but it always just kind of felt like a overly commercialized reason to go buy flowers, chocolates, and have an expensive dinner out, which all of those we are wont to do. Just on this particular day, I never really understood it, and I think we did it for a couple years, and then we're just like, yeah, whatever. I think we're going to order Chinese tonight, and I think we're going to watch Landman. I think we're going to binge watch Landman tonight. Heard nothing but good reviews about Landman and Billy Bob Thornton and the whole crew putting that together. So I think we're going to do that tonight. But so happy Valentine's Day if that's something you enjoy doing. I must apologize. I have to do a little
clean up on aisle 5, please. Clean up on aisle 5.
In regards to one of my statements from the last episode. I mean, how irresponsible of me. I am a purveyor of truth on this show. I am never going to say anything that is knowingly not true. In the last episode, I said that Doge had discovered, amidst all the fraud at USAID, a $70,000 transgender play in Italy. I was trying to do this from memory. So I said it was a $70,000 transgender play in Italy. Shame on me. I'm so embarrassed. It was actually a $70,000 DEI musical in Ireland. So, we are all about being factual here. So, there is your
clean up on aisle 5, please. Clean up on aisle 5.
On my gross misstatement of the $70,000 expenditure at USAID, among many others, that had been directed to the most ludicrous, unbelievably wasteful, far loony bin left-wing causes. We don't need to revisit it. If you want to go back, I mean, the lists are out there. These lists are getting longer every single day. They're tearing into the Department of Education right now, again, on a read-only basis at the behest of the president. And they are, I saw some videos today that will absolutely blow your mind. The people that are teaching our children, oh my God in heaven, if you can do it, I wish I could. If you can do it, homeschool your kids. It is atrocious what is going on behind the scenes at the Department of Education. Under the guise of teaching our children, it is despicable what has been going on for years in that agency. And it is high time we tear that thing down to the studs, get everybody out, and burn it. Return education back to the states and local municipalities where it belongs, where the actual teachers are, where the parents are, where the students are. if the hundreds of billions of dollars that we have thrown at that department over the last 45-ish years hasn't been indicative enough of its complete and utter failure, especially when you look at where we were globally in education in 1979 compared to today. Just go out there and look at some videos that are being surfaced by people that actually do have our best interest in mind and are not going to let these people get away with this blatant, disgusting indoctrination anymore. It will blow your mind. It will make you want to vomit. All at the same time, if you can do it, homeschool your kids. Like I said, I wish I was in a position to do it myself, but you know, we don't all have that luxury, partly because of the Department of Education. Anywho, I did want to update you on our resolution episode. I mean, we're a month and a half into the new year here, and most of the time, New Year's resolutions have long since been forgotten, especially by me in years past. Very rarely have I taken anything into February, but you know what? They're still top of mind. I still think about them every day. I've got a ledger that I'm keeping track of all these things. I'm down about 5.6 pounds so far. Today's weigh-in was 209.6. I have gotten as low as 208.6. And that was pre-Super Bowl weekend. No, we'll get back to that. But it's not coming off as fast as I was expecting. But technically, we're on track. My activity level will undoubtedly increase once we get winter behind us. Because I know I live in Minnesota, and this is going to sound extremely counterintuitive. I hate winter. I hate being cold. I hate snow. I hate ice. I never played hockey. I hate ice fishing. I hate the sound of snowmobiles. I like absolutely. Once you get past Christmas, I love Christmas, and I love snow at Christmas. But after that, I'm done with the whole thing. And sadly, up here, I mean, you can have 3, sometimes 4 months of winter post-Christmas. And yeah, my activity level drops to almost nothing this time of year. So hopefully that'll get better once the weather, once we get to spring and summer and start getting a little closer to that goal of mine of 189. Because, boy, that feels like a long way away. But technically, mathematically at least, we're on track. I'm on track on the water intake. I've been doing way better with that than I ever did before, being far more conscious about it. So we're on track there. Cutting the spending, doing okay there. That one's a little harder to track. But, I think of that resolution every time I think of buying a non-necessity. So it's having at least some of the desired effect. And yes, I have turned some of those things away. So push-ups were on track until I got sick, and then I fell behind. I finished January averaging just under 19 a day instead of 25, but we got 11 months to catch up here. I like an idiot, I tried to catch up last weekend kind of all at once, and I overdid it on back-to-back days and then slightly sprained the same wrist that has given me problems before. So yeah, getting old rocks. So I'm trying to strike that balance between being a complete and utter idiot and doing way too much and not doing enough, which is definitely my tendency. So at least for February, I know I'm ahead, but overall probably still a bit behind. And, that illness certainly didn't help. But 3 reach outs so far to old friends that I haven't talked to in a while. So we're on track there. Church, we're on track. It's still not perfect. It needs to be better. But again, mathematically, we're on track. I grabbed the guitar a few days ago. Now, that was the first time this year, so we're not where we need to be there. I am going to do it again tonight, so that will be 2 noticeably rusty, hoy vey, and the callus buildup is completely gone, so it hurt like the first day of guitar class all over again, and after, I struggled through about a song and a half, and it was hurting pretty bad. I stuck with it as long as I could, probably about a half hour. I think I played like 4 or 5 songs. Yeah, it hurt pretty good. So we've got a lot of rebuilding to do there, both as far as building up the pain tolerance and building up the skin on the fingers and just doing it more frequently. I love it. I really want to get better at it. And, I guess part of it is the frustration that at this age, it's just things just don't come to you as naturally as they do when you're younger. So I don't feel like I was, a big reason that I got away from it in the first place was I just wasn't making the progress I I felt like I should have been. And, you know, I got to get over that. You're not going to learn it as fast when you're older, but you still can learn it. You know, it just takes a little longer, takes a little more work, but we'll get on track there. So, yeah, mostly on track. I need to do better in a few areas, but it is having the desired effect. I think about these things every day, which is far more than I can say about any New Year's resolutions I've had in the past. So even a month and a half in here, it's all still top of mind every day, which is a good thing, and it helps keep me mostly on track. I want to talk about debt. A couple different kinds, actually. First, I want to talk about, in honor of Doge and in honor of what this administration is attempting to do that no administration in recent history has had the guts to do, and that is cut the federal budget, reduce that deficit, at least make an attempt to get to a balanced budget and stop adding this insane amount of debt to our national debt every single year. Our national debt currently sits at $36.2 trillion. I think I threw out 33 the other day. Apparently, I'm living in mid-2023. No, our current national debt is $36.2 trillion. We are adding $1 trillion to that about every 100 days. Now, you know, these numbers get thrown around so much. I think most of us are numb to them. A trillion can be hard to comprehend. I mean, you know, it's another set of zeros from billion, whatever, but just the sheer amount of a trillion of anything can be really, really hard to comprehend. So I want to do a little comparison here. Just 1 million seconds. We can all kind of quantify a million in our heads. 1 million seconds is about 11 days and 13 hours. 1 million seconds, about 11 and a half days. 1 billion seconds is 31.7 years. Okay, stick with me here. 1 million seconds, 11 and a half days. 1 billion seconds, 31.7 years. 1 trillion seconds is 31,688 years. Okay, 1 trillion is a really big number. According to CNBC, Moody's Investor Service downgraded the outlook on the U.S. government from stable to negative in November 2023 due to ongoing and ever-increasing concerns about the U.S. national debt. And I would add a lack of any coherent plan to deal with it. Now, not all national debts are created equal. You all have heard the term gross domestic product before, which is the total value of goods and services produced in a country. In this case, we're talking about the United States, of course. The U.S. GDP, gross domestic product. The U.S. GDP in 2024 was just under $29 trillion. Now, that's the largest economy in the world. China was second at about $18.5 trillion. A better way of gauging a country's debt isn't necessarily the total dollar amount, but comparing it as a percentage of GDP is a good way to determine just how in trouble a country is with its debt compared to how much it produces. So like I said, not all debts when it comes to national debts are created equal. Depending on how much economic activity a country creates, various levels of debt could be more or less of a serious problem. The United States sits at 129%. Our debt is 129% of our annual GDP. We're not the worst. That's not great. We are the ninth highest percentage in the world. Japan is by far and away number one at 264%. You've probably heard about the yen and all the issues that Japan is having with entitlements and, you know, they're facing a lot of the income guarantee problems that America is facing, and that their population's living longer, and in Japan's case, living way longer than anyone anticipated when they set up these social safety nets, and it's going to come to a head there. Something's going to happen in Japan. I don't know what it is, but you can't run your national debt at 264% of GDP. That's just that is not sustainable. Number two is Venezuela. You're probably familiar with this story as well. Their economy basically crashed, and their currency largely became worthless because of the amount of their debt. Next on the list, Sudan. Greece, which I'm sure you've heard about, has had serious ongoing economic trouble for years. Singapore, I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, Eritrea, which is a country that borders Sudan in Africa. Lebanon, Italy, and then us at number nine. This is not a great list to be on, and it is becoming a larger and larger problem. The debt level is rising faster than it ever has. Now, the interest costs, because that's something that nobody likes to even talk about either, and it's easy to lose that in the shuffle here. Just the interest cost in 2024 on our national debt was $308 billion. Now, those interest costs are going to vary depending on the total amount of debt and the interest rates, which obviously can fluctuate over time. Now, our debt is obviously going to continue to rise until we actually have the balls to do something about it. Now, interest rates have stalled, and in my opinion, based on people that I've listened to, they probably aren't going to move much, as obviously there's an appetite for lower interest rates, but that is being thwarted by this ongoing persistent inflation that is still not completely under control. Our interest payments on the debt now trail only Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and National Defense as far as total percentage of the U.S. budget. So if you separate those all out, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, National Defense, interest on the debt is our fifth most expensive line item on the budget. That's not good. We're getting absolutely nothing out of our fifth largest expense, other than the right to continue to carry this insane amount of debt. So obviously something has to be done about this. We cannot keep kicking this proverbial can down the road in perpetuity, because what happened in Greece, what happened in Venezuela, and what almost happened in Argentina, and what is probably yet to happen in Japan, it can all happen here. We are not immune to fiscal and economic realities. They don't care about your feelings. They don't care about your emotions. They don't care how important whatever it is you're trying to fund is. Economic realities are what they are. And I think sometimes we feel like that stuff can't happen to us. It absolutely can. Go back and study what happened in Greece and Venezuela. This did not happen in the 1800s. This happened in the last decade or two. And you know what? What we're doing is immoral. Because it's going to be our children, our grandchildren, and generations beyond that will have to suffer the worst consequences of this grotesque overspending and our complete lack of apparent desire as a country to seriously deal with it. You know, think about that the next time someone tries to defend this bloated, overinflated federal government. But this is what politicians do, mostly on the left, but there's plenty of them on the right, too. Someone will talk about cutting, and some hysterical politician will get on TV and scream about the instantaneous death of children across the world, and your grandmother never seeing a Social Security check again because of the cutting that you're talking about. These people are so like children. We have to be able to talk about this like grown-ass adults, so as to avoid our country suffering the same fate as Greece or Venezuela. Again, go do some reading about what happened there. You know, especially in Venezuela. They used to be one of the wealthiest countries in the Western Hemisphere. They have some of the biggest oil reserves on the planet. That didn't save them. And that's out there. That could be us if we don't act. And Doge is a perfect example of somebody trying to do something, albeit, you know, think what you want about their tactics. At least they're trying. Trump was elected partially on his promise to cut the size of government and at least attempt to get this debt under control. It needs to be done legally. It needs to be done transparently. Well, they've definitely got the transparency covered. I mean, Doge has its own website. You can go on there and follow what they're doing. They update it constantly. You can find everything they've found is on there. And from what I understand, they're doing everything legally. This constitutional crisis BS being spoon-fed to the Democrats and the legacy media and them just regurgitating it as the good little obedient servants that they are. We've talked about how indefensible this fraud is. Just the stuff they've already found, which should infuriate you. And they're finding more every single day. With every single rock they look under, they're finding more. And some of it more ridiculous than anything that came before it. So naturally, the Democrats have filed over 50 lawsuits nationwide, shopping around for activist judges that will do their bidding. And over a dozen national injunctions have already been issued to slow the progress. I mean, man, you want to talk about a constitutional crisis? How about a singular activist judge in an uber-progressive district having the power to single-handedly stop executive actions without having to cite a single law or statute that's been violated? How about that for a constitutional crisis? This is something that needs to be fixed. No single federal district court judge should have that kind of power. I mean, at the very least, something like this needs to at least go directly to the circuit court level and be ruled on by a panel. Speaking of judges, this is something that's becoming more and more of a concern of mine, too. Judges using the power of their bench, not to adjudicate the law as it was written, but openly and blatantly to advance their politics. Not fairly interpret and apply the law, just advance their own ideology. Here's just one example. This is the federal judge in Rhode Island that blocked Trump's executive order on the federal spending pause as DOGE was getting its wheels going and finding all this fraud. And they said, whoa, hold the phone here. We can't even believe what we're finding here. We don't want any of this to continue while we're searching, because it's going to take a while to go through all this. We want this stopped, and we'll start it again once we are confident everything is on the up and up. Well, this federal judge in Rhode Island didn't like that, so he issued the injunction that stopped that spending pause. Now, you listen to this guy talk here, and you tell me, does this sound like an equal applicator of the law that is even remotely tied to the U.S. Constitution?
When you're sentencing someone, when we talk about sentencing, that you have to take a moment and realize that this, you know, middle-class, white, male, privileged person needs to understand the human being that comes before us, that maybe a woman, and maybe black, maybe transgender, maybe poor, maybe rich, maybe whatever, may have experiences that aren't yours, and you have to walk in their shoes and understand that the law applies to them where they are, and then you have to apply the law accordingly.
The law applies to them where they are? This is a federal judge appointed by, to absolutely nobody's surprise, Barack Obama. That's a federal judge that has the power to sentence you, that has the power to determine what is objectionable in your case and what is not, if you're sitting as a defendant in that courtroom. How many things did he list off right at the beginning there? As a federal judge, I need to see who's in front of me, whether it's a woman, whether they're black, whether they're transgender, whether they're blah, 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 blah. Your Honor, and I use that term very loosely, but only out of respect for the position, not the man. Your Honor, objection, relevance. How on earth is that human being occupying a position of that kind of power with those kinds of biases guiding him in his decision making? Now, I'm not saying that any judge, lawyer, everyone has their biases, okay? Can we get past that? Judges are there to interpret the law and apply it equally. Blind. Remember the Statue of Justice? She's got a blindfold on. Because whether the person is transgender or black or a woman or whatever other group he decided to carve out there, none of that is relevant. This is the person that stopped the President of the United States' perfectly legal executive order. President of the United States now has to defend his action against this judge. Do you think this judge is going to adjudicate this case fairly? I've got more for you.
We all have have racism, obviously, but not the overt kind.
We all have racism in us. Just not the overt kind, apparently, like his. Some of us are better at hiding it. I'm going to say again, this is a federal judge. This isn't some loony bin, left-wing lunatic that's four levels deep on the dark web. This is a federal judge in a federal court in the state of Rhode Island. This person could be the one sentencing you. This person could be overseeing your trial. You want more?
What? I've never been personally subjected to racism. And racism plays such a huge role in the criminal justice system, from who gets stopped to who gets arrested to who gets prosecuted and how they get prosecuted and how they spend time in jail and everything along that horrible road. I've never experienced that. And that makes it hard, or it makes it easy to ignore that, right?
Right.
But it makes it hard not to when there's no diversity, when you don't have colleagues that you can speak to, or when you're not diverse yourself. And make no mistake about it, race is present every single day in the courtroom, predominantly in criminal cases, but it's present in a goodly number of the civil cases that we do as well. So, you know, diversity is important everywhere. It is vitally important in the judiciary. You know, it's not shocking that President Obama had a great track record of ensuring diversity, racial diversity amongst the bench. President Trump, not so much. I don't think he pointed a single person of color to the Court of Appeals, and very few people to the district court. So I'm hoping that President Biden will prioritize racial diversity on the bench as well, because if you don't have diversity of thought, then the courts aren't going to work right? Because if we're there to protect the minority while upholding the values of the Constitution, then it's going to be, you know, middle class white male rule continues.
Did you get all that? I think we had 7 mentions of diversity before we finally got to that annoying detail of, yes, and upholding the values of the Constitution and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, no. But, you know, the white man is bad. Yes, racism is clearly present in this guy's court every single day. I love how, don't you love how they project that onto everyone else as if that's a normal way to think? As if we're all walking around with those thoughts in our head? That's the lens we see the world through? That's the guy who stopped the President of the United States from stopping the waste of your tax money. He even mentioned Obama, Trump, and Biden by name. Obama did a great job of diversity on the bench. No mention of merit. Zero. I've got 5-6 sound bites of this clown. Not one mention of, do you know what you're doing? Did you win cases as an attorney? Were you a successful prosecutor? What were your grades in law school? Did you graduate at the top of your class? How did you do on the bar? None of it. None of it. There was not one legal analysis in any of that you just heard. Every bit of that was activism. Not one shred of that is justice. That's the person who just guaranteed that the federal government can continue to waste your money. That, my friends, is your constitutional crisis. And would it be too much to ask the Democrats to stop appointing people like that to positions of power? Would that be too much to ask? Absolutely disgusting. Unacceptable. That guy does not belong in the federal bench. He belongs at the DNC running against David Hogg for vice chair. Not sitting in a courtroom with people's legal lives in his hands. It's disgusting, and in my opinion, that's impeachment worthy. That little diatribe right there. Even in that one answer, it took him almost 2 minutes to get to the part where, oh yeah, and uphold the United States Constitution. After he mentions diversity and racism 17 times. We cannot have judges using these kinds of powerful positions in our society to advance their personal, social, and racial politics. But these are the kinds of judges that Democrats appoint. Because they want them to legislate from the bench, not apply existing law as it's written. They want them to legislate and project their activism from the federal bench. This is a huge problem that needs to be dealt with. Thank God in Trump's first term, and yes, with the help of the much maligned Mitch McConnell, for getting a lot of originalist judges into our federal court system. It helped stem the tide of this activist nonsense that Bill Clinton kind of started and Barack Obama put on steroids. Okay, we got a little sidetracked there. But the point is, back to the debt issue, this issue's not going away on its own. Okay, it needs to be actively dealt with. Yet we have an entire political party, with little to no exceptions that I can find, that are full on against it and actively working to stop it. Again, they keep citing these straw man arguments about what little good there is coming out of these enormous wasteful bureaucracies. You know who else did some good things among many, many bad things? The mob. Organized crime. They did some good things to cover up all the bad stuff they were doing. Is that what we want our federal government to run like? These straw man arguments about, oh, yep, there they go. They just cut this funding for this AIDS research in Zimbabwe. You know what? If AIDS research in Zimbabwe got cut because they cut out 97 other things that were absolute grift within USAID, you know, sorry if one thing got caught in the shuffle. You know, maybe you guys shouldn't have corrupted it to the degree that you did. That stuff's going to be put back. You know, is Doge going about this in a bit of a wrecking ball kind of way? Well, yes. And Anna Kasparian, she's the co-host of Young Turks, a very popular podcast among the left. She's definitely of the left, but she's got some common sense. And she seems to be coming to the side of reason a little more each day. And she made a very good point on the Megyn Kelly show yesterday or the day before about this, that look, I'm in favor of what they're doing. I would just like a little more discretion as they go. And that's a fair argument. So yes, when you take this approach, it's inevitable that some things that actually provide some value and are important to our national interest and our influence throughout the world are going to get caught up in it, you know, in some sort of collateral damage or unintended consequence. Now, I'm firmly of the belief, and I'll be the first person to come on this show and admit if I'm wrong, but I'm firmly of the belief that anything of value that accidentally gets lost in this shuffle will quickly be put back, and hopefully even improved with more money being available for all these good things once we cut out all the bad things. That's a reasonable way of looking at this. But Democrats, they just can't help themselves. Well, Trump's doing it, so it must be bad. Just period. That is the lens. Those are the two lenses that the Democrats see the world through right now. Identity politics and Trump did it, so it's bad. They've actually taken the position of protecting this bureaucracy instead of trimming the fat and using the savings to improve upon what is good. I can't imagine this is going to help their 31% approval rating, but, you know, who knows? Short-sighted American voters have certainly surprised me before and undoubtedly are capable of surprising me again. This is the first serious step that any administration, Republican or Democrat, since Bill Clinton, to make a serious effort at addressing our national debt and our annual budget deficit issues. This needs to get done. Within the law, keeping what's good, getting rid of the fraud, the waste, the excess, it needs to get done. Turning the page on debt now from national to personal. No, national debt isn't the only debt problem facing this country. In addition to the federal debt being as high as it's ever been, total consumer debt is also at an all-time high. According to an article written by Alicia Wallace of CNN, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York released its latest consumer debt figures for the fourth quarter of 2024, showing total consumer debt was just over $18 trillion. Here's that trillion again. This is the highest amount ever recorded. Now, broken down among many different debt types, and this data is actually from the third quarter. I couldn't find it for the fourth quarter, so it's, you know, 3 months outdated. But it'll certainly get the point across, and I can't imagine these numbers have changed much in 3 months. Now, I'm no financial analyst, but I do have a degree in finance, so I feel like I can speak on a somewhat educated level on this, and I see some trends here that are unsettling, to say the least. Not the least of which is that we as consumers are more in debt than we've ever been before. But I'm going to give you a hypothesis or two of mine as to what these numbers might be indicating. Now, I'll let you know when I'm getting to the opinion part of this, because some of this is going to be my opinion, but the numbers are concrete. These numbers are all courtesy of Experian. They are one of the three credit bureaus. Mortgage debt. Now, remember, the total number was just over $18 trillion. Mortgage debt is $12.1 trillion of that. That's up 4.2% from 2023. Incidentally, and I looked this up more out of curiosity, the total combined value of all real estate in the United States is about $49 trillion. So only about a quarter of that is consumer mortgages. Or only about a quarter of that is mortgaged by the consumer. Home equity lines of credit, hereafter referred to as HELOCs. HELOC balances were up almost 10% last year to about $360 billion. Student loan debt dropped 16.8% to $1.23 trillion. Three guesses as to why. No. Not because people paid them off. They just got transferred to the national debt via the court-defying, illegal, constitutional, crisis-worthy actions of former President Joe Biden. Auto loan balances were up slightly, 1.5% to $1.54 trillion, which I would say, now this is opinion here, I would say that this is almost entirely due to simply the increased price of vehicles, both new and used, but not jumping crazily because not as many people are buying cars in this high interest rate environment. Credit card debt jumped almost 9% to $1.16 trillion. That number is also a record high, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is scary. This is all toxic debt, most of which comes with extremely high interest rates in the high teens, 20%, even 30% range. We'll get to more on credit card debt in a minute here. Retail cards, like store credit cards, were largely unchanged at about $127 billion. And personal loan balances dropped 3.2% to about $555 billion. We're going to talk more about personal loans here in a minute as well. But I would argue that that's based on nothing more than the fact that personal loans have been harder for people to get as their financial picture continues to deteriorate, making them less appealing, less creditworthy to potential lenders. And then, you know, there's the added cost of the higher interest rates on top of that. But we'll get to more on that in a second. There's three of those figures that I want to focus on in particular. And this is applying my dated, but I think still relevant, finance background. Three figures I want to talk about a little more there. The HELOC, the home equity line of credit figure, the credit card figure, and the personal loan figure. Now, the HELOC figure concerns me for a number of reasons. This was the highest percentage increase of any of those debt categories as they were laid out. Now, HELOCs can be a very effective and relatively low-cost way to pay for things, such as home improvements, and they can also be used to consolidate debts, you know, that have accrued in less desirable accounts, such as credit cards or personal loans. And while HELOCs almost always offer a lower interest rate than most of these other alternatives, it's still a consumer borrowing against what is likely their largest asset and their greatest source of wealth or equity, which is their home. Now, HELOCs currently range from about 7.5% to 11.5% based on a number of different factors, most importantly, of course, the borrower's credit history. Whereas the average mortgage rate as of today is 6.87. So on a HELOC, you're going to pay a little bit more on the interest front, but definitely not as much as credit cards, and in almost all cases, less than any personal loan you're going to find too. So many owners of HELOCs have mortgages that are slightly older. It's not very often you open up a HELOC shortly after buying a home, because in most cases, you don't have a whole lot of equity shortly after buying a home. So a lot of people that have these have older mortgages, and as such are probably sitting at much more attractive interest rates like the ones we were used to for the better part of two decades before the inflation crisis hit. So in my opinion, HELOCs are being used as opposed to refinancing in this inflated interest rate environment that we're in. And I feel like that's backed up by the fact, again, this is my opinion here, but I feel like it's backed up by the fact that despite still stubbornly increasing real estate prices and the current rates being more than twice what they were just a few years ago, mortgage debt itself was only up 4.2% compared to HELOCs jumping almost 10%. HELOCs are they're the most cost-efficient debt tool to use once they're in place, as opposed to a full refinance, which can cost thousands of dollars and likely would not make much sense to American homeowners right now, given the interest rate environment today compared to what it was a couple of years ago and what it will hopefully be again at some point in the future. So my concern about the HELOC figure is I fear that many more credit-worthy borrowers, those with higher credit scores and more equity in their homes, they're using this as a first line of defense as their day-to-day budget becomes harder and harder to manage. And we're going to get to that in a minute here as well. Using your home as a bank, which, hey, I'm not throwing shade here. I have done it far too much in my life. So I am not casting any shade on anybody here by any means. But using your home as a bank is not a long-term solution, and it can lead to an ever-increasingly persistent and ever-increasingly burdensome financial struggle in the future. They aren't bad. HELOCs are not bad. But when they're used in the wrong way, they can be a gateway to a much more toxic and difficult debt situation to manage. Which leads me to the second number that I find particularly troubling, which is, of course, the credit card figure. Again, $1.16 trillion, up almost 9% in just 1 year. Again, that's the highest level of credit card debt ever recorded. And like I said, this debt is almost always accompanied by extremely high interest rates. I looked it up today. The average credit card today, 24.2%. 24.2% is the average interest rate on a credit card in 2024-25. Yes, there are cards that carry lower rates, but those are almost exclusively reserved for very high income earners with very, very high credit scores. And this population, by definition, almost never carries balances on their credit cards. They will use them, but they will pay them off every month, thereby being able to take advantage of the cash back or the travel miles bonuses or whatever bonus is offered by many credit cards without the downside of carrying these interest charging balances. My gut feeling here is that most, if not the vast majority of this $1.16 trillion is being carried by those who are going to struggle the most to pay it back. And to me, the fact that this number has hit an all-time high signals that this group that's going to struggle the most, in which I would certainly place myself and my family, is finding it harder and harder to make ends meet. And they're using more and more of their available credit, which then turns into toxic debt as a result. And that leads me to the third figure that I find particularly concerning, which is the personal loans. Now again, personal loan balances fell 3.2% to $555 billion. But JD, these balances went down. How could this be concerning? Isn't that a good thing? Well, in a vacuum, yes, it would be, and it could be, but it might not be. And judging from the other two numbers that we already discussed in detail, I don't think that it is. And here's why I fear it's a bad sign. Again, speaking from personal experience here, personal loans to me are a last resort. Yes, their interest rates are typically lower than credit cards. As of today, the average rate for a personal loan is about 12.4%. Higher than a HELOC, much lower than the average credit card. But follow my logic here. Almost everyone has a credit card, or several. Now, people that would like to eliminate debt will often turn to HELOCs first, as they cost less on the front end and almost always carry lower rates than do personal loans. Now, some people don't want to borrow against their house and will go straight to the personal loan solution when looking to consolidate balances and or make home improvements, you know, make big purchases, take a vacation, whatever. But most will use credit cards first and then use a personal loan if they're getting uncomfortable with their balances. Now, in my history, I've used all of these borrowing sources repeatedly and en masse over the years. Personal loans in my history are typically reserved for the situations when your immediate cash reserves are spent and your easy access credit cards are starting to carry balances that are making you uncomfortable. So why would credit card balances jump almost 9% while personal loan balances dropped 3%? This is my opinion. This is my theory. My theory is this. People are increasingly resorting to their credit cards for basic expenditures, not excesses, not the frivolous stuff, not the luxuries. This inflation has gone on so hard for so long. I truly feel like people are using their available credit that they've amassed, probably most of it amassed during the economic boom of 2017 to 2019, and are increasingly relying on it as the inflation environment has persisted while wages have not come anywhere close to keeping up. As more and more of this available credit is used, it whittles away at the borrower's credit score. It's one of the dirty little secrets of using credit. Lenders want you to have it. They almost insist on seeing that you have it when you seek to borrow from them. But then you get in and you use it, and the industry then penalizes you at an ever-increasing rate if you dare to use it. And once you are using a certain percentage of that available credit, everybody's got their own rules, but once you hit that magic number, using that a certain percentage of your available credit, this quote-unquote having credit, which initially helps you at the outset and helps your credit score, starts to work against you. And the more of your available credit that you use, the lower your score gets. And no, it isn't fair. You can keep up on every payment, make every payment on time, early. Pay the minimum, pay more than a minimum, pay five times the minimum. It doesn't matter. Once you start using what lenders view as an unhealthy amount of the credit that you've earned, that you have available to you, they start punishing you by downgrading you as a borrower, and it lowers your credit score. So now, when you've been forced to use these credit accounts more than you'd like because your income has not been able to keep up with your basic expenses, and you seek to consolidate these higher interest credit card balances with, say, a lower rate personal loan, you aren't as credit worthy as you were before. Even though you've done nothing wrong, you've missed no payments, you're not delinquent on any accounts, you're not getting any collection calls, none of that matters. Just the fact that you're using it because of the external economic factors that have been forced upon you through no fault of your own is enough to make you less credit worthy. So now, when you seek a personal loan at this stage, one of two things is going to happen. Either the loan offer that you're going to be able to get is so unappealing you decide not even to bother with it, or even worse, you don't qualify at all. That's why I think credit card balances have increased while personal loan balances have decreased. That is my theory. There's nothing I can cite there. That is not anyone else's idea. That is my theory. Could be right, could be wrong, but that is my gut feeling. I think those that have been forced to use their credit cards are now finding themselves in an environment where they are less appealing as borrowers to potential lenders. These lenders have tightened things up a bit themselves, and these people with higher balances are finding their credit scores in the toilet and being faced with exponentially higher interest rates on any personal loan that they seek out than they ever imagined, if they can qualify for one at all. I feel this is leaving people that are disproportionately contributing to this record high consumer credit card debt. I think they're living on the edge. I really do. They're utilizing whatever credit they have available to them, and it gets harder and harder every month. As your balances grow and grow and your available credit shrinks and shrinks, not because they're out there buying Lululemon leggings or Gucci handbags, just the cost of basic living, the cost of average stuff is quickly exceeding the average American's reach. And that brings me to my last point for today. I I mentioned several episodes ago about working on a piece called Average People, Average Stuff, and we're going to get into that right now. Almost everyone has a mortgage. You know, God bless those who don't have them, who have the ability to avoid them. You know, that's not my reality, so I'm not going to pretend that it's the reality of most of the people I'm talking to. Experts say that there should be no more than 28% of your gross income tied into your mortgage. Now, that includes your principal, your interest, your taxes, and your insurance. This varies on a lot of factors, but again, we're going to be dealing with averages here, which, yes, outliers can throw off averages. We all know that, but for the purposes of this exercise, we're going to be using averages, which I think will paint the proper picture. The average mortgage payment in America right now is about $2,200. So that means that to afford the average home in America, a household needs to make just over $94,000 a year to slide in under that 28% of gross income figure. Well, the median household income in the United States in 2024 was $82,000, not $94,000. You need $94,000 to make the average house payment, but you make $82,000. That's an almost 15% shortfall. That isn't going to work. It's been going on for a long time, and I feel like this is a huge contributor to that massive increase in HELOC and credit card debt that we talked about last segment. Now, let's go through the budget of this average $82,000 household income household. Let's analyze what a household with an income of $82,000 is up against in today's economy. Now, again, these are all average figures. I'm aware of outliers. Yes, medians can sometimes be a more effective means of figuring stuff like this out. We're going to use averages, okay? Because we're going to get into like utility bills and things like that. It's awfully hard to find a median utility bill. So we're going with averages. Stick with me here. Again, I think it'll paint the picture I'm trying to portray here. So your income is $82,000. I'm going to use my glorious state of Minnesota as an example here. In Minnesota, I looked this up today. If I make $82,000 a year, I am going to be taxed around $22,000 on that income between state, local, and federal taxes. So you start off at $82,000. We're taking $22,000 right off the top. That leaves you $60,000 after taxes for the average household, which conveniently breaks down to $5,000 a month. Okay? So let's see how far that goes. Again, you've got your average mortgage payment of $2,200. So take that right off the top. You're down to $2,800. We're going to deal with a family of four here. Two adults, two kids. Seems pretty average to me. To make $82,000, it's likely you're going to need two incomes. You're going to need two cars. Maybe you don't even need the two incomes, but you still need two cars. Somebody's got to go to work. Somebody's got to move the kids around. So you need two cars. Well, the average new car payment is $737 a month. The average used car payment is $520. So let's say you're being super cautious and you're only going to drive used vehicles. So we have two vehicles at $520 a month each. That's $1,040 off your $2,800 you had left after your mortgage. So now you're down to $1,760. If you got cars, you got to insure them. The average cost for insuring a vehicle, $222 a month. Let's say you found a great deal. You're driving used cars, so you're probably on the lower end of that number. Let's say you got the best deal around and you're able to insure both your cars for $222 a month. So as far as the average goes, I'm basically cutting this cost in half. So you got full coverage on both your cars for $222 a month. Now you're down to $1,538. If you're going to drive them, you got to gas them. Average cost of gas per vehicle, $175 per car per month. Times two, that's $350. Now you're down to $1,208. Electricity, average bill nationwide, $145. You're down to $1,063. Water, average water bill is $39. That sounds really low to me, but hey, we're going to go with it. You're down to $1,024. Natural gas, if that's how you heat, if that's how you cool, whatever it is, if that's how you cook, $100 a month on average. Now you're down to $924. Garbage bill. Average garbage bill is about $60 a month. You're down to $864. How about heat? Now, that varies wildly by climate, but if you don't need heat, you probably are going to be paying a much higher electric bill than the 145 we talked about to cool your house, say in Florida. So I say that all comes out in the wash. The average heating bill combined through all different sources, you got propane, you got natural gas, you got heating oil, you got electric, geothermal, on and on. The average cost around the country for all sources is about $90 a month. You're down to $774. Average food cost for a family of four, according to the USDA, a family of four will pay on average between $567 and $1,296 per month on food, depending on a variety of factors. Okay, fine. We're going to take the lowest number available there. Yes, the range goes from $567 to $1,296. $567 sounds pretty darn low for a family of four for a month's worth of food. Trust me, as somebody who shops for a family of four. But let's go with it. You're down to $207. The average clothing cost for a family of four, $170 a month. Of course, it doesn't all happen at once. Probably happens right before the summer, right before school. $170 a month. That's the figure that I found. You're down to $37. Average cell phone bill for a family of four. And don't tell me cell phones aren't necessary. It's 2025, folks. 1982 called. They want their family budget back. Average cell phone bill for a family of four, give or take $200 a month. You're now in the hole, $163. So we're already broke. We're already in the red. We're already borrowing money just to make these basic ends meet. Was there any fluff in there? Go back and listen to that again. Was there any luxury? That's all average stuff. And I would classify every one of them, as necessities. My cell phone isn't necessary. Bull crap, it isn't. You need an app to do just about anything these days, even at school half the time. Here's what isn't on that list. Remember, as an average American, you're already broke. After taxes, an average house, two average used cars with average insurance, a family of four spending the low average amount of money on food and clothing with average utility bills with an average commute. You're broke. Well, let's consider some things that aren't on that list. Remember, we're already in debt. We're already borrowing. Things that weren't on that list? Internet. Any entertainment or streaming service or TV for any in-home entertainment. You're broke and you're sitting around at home staring at each other because you have no internet, no TV, no spending on household goods like dishes, appliances, linens, electronics. No money whatsoever for home improvements or even basic maintenance. You still have to pay license tabs, your annual registration on both those vehicles. You haven't bought a single birthday present. You haven't bought one Christmas present. You don't have any decorations to help your family enjoy the holidays. Any of them. You haven't bought your kids any Easter candy. No Halloween costumes. You don't even have a savings account. Why would you? For what? You haven't contributed to your retirement account, your 401k, your 503c. You haven't traveled anywhere, ever. You haven't gone and visited a friend. You have no health insurance, and none of you have been to any medical appointments of any kind. You have no life insurance to help your children in case the worst should happen. You haven't gone out to dinner for your anniversary or Valentine's Day. You haven't put on a single birthday party for your kids or anyone else. You haven't repaired that broken window or that leaky faucet, both of which are causing your utility bills to be higher than they need to be. You haven't yet repaired either one of those used cars, no matter what it needs. You haven't bought a single school supply. What about haircuts? Basic personal maintenance? Nope, haven't done any of that. You have no pets. Or if you do, you haven't paid for them, or fed them, or taken them to the vet once a year, at least, to properly take care of them. You have no gaming systems, no subscriptions to anything, no music, no movies, no games, no nothing. You can't save for your kids' school. You can't save for your daughter's wedding. nor either one of their graduation parties. You haven't repaired your backyard fence that was damaged in that storm last summer because you can't afford to make a claim on it against your homeowner's insurance because you can't afford the higher premium. Even if you could, you don't have the money for the deductible saved because you can't. And you can't afford to fix it on your own. You have no toiletries, no cleaning products, no laundry soap, toothpaste. And you don't have dental insurance, so you haven't been to the dentist. You have no vision insurance, so you haven't been to the eye doctor. None of you have. Meanwhile, the cost of all of this is going up steadily, 4, 5, 6, 7% per year. While your raises, if you get them at all, are amounting to 2 or 3%. This is what I mean when I say average people cannot afford average stuff. They can't afford average things. They can't afford an average life. Now, again, some people are going to try to poke holes in this and say, well, averages aren't universal, and it depends on a lot of variables and location and this, that, and the other. I'm using averages. Statistics provided by the U.S. government agencies and reputable credit bureaus. I don't know how you could better depict what the average American family is facing right now, trying to live an average life with average things. I'll tell you what, I got into this analysis and it was even worse than I thought. I thought I'd at least get the insurances paid for before we ran out of money. I couldn't even make it that far. Again, no internet. It's the information age. How's a family supposed to live without internet? Our kids had to use the internet to go to school for 18 months or longer, depending on where you lived.
Oh, well, the government will pay for it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, yeah, that's the answer. Go seek out a government program offered by the only institution on earth that's more in debt than the average American family. No thanks. That's not a solution. In fact, I would argue that's part of the larger problem. It's scary stuff. And I think more people are facing it than you'd think. I'm sure a lot of you are facing it on some level. I sure as hell am. Maybe your kids are grown now and your costs are a little lower. Maybe your circumstances are a little different. Well, that's why we call them averages. Some have it better. Some even have it worse than this. But this is what the average American family is facing right now. It's scary. It's demoralizing. And it's unsustainable. So, coming up, still waiting on that friend of mine for our debate. You know, she's got that new job, so I'm not pestering her about it right now. And from what I understand, she's done with her training, but now her, you know, now she's actually doing the job, and her schedule's all over the place. So, congratulations, GM, if you're out there and you're listening to this. I know she has listened, but in the past. It will happen. Stay tuned. You know, it might be a little while, but I am 100% confident that's going to happen. Honestly, I wouldn't mind getting that friend that I was arguing with last week about Elon and Doge in here too. I mean, he's a really good guy. I mean, we're clearly polar opposites, even more than GM and I are. We're clearly polar opposites on the current political spectrum, and we've gotten into a couple rather heated discussions in the past few months. I think we're good enough friends and have enough mutual respect for each other that we could get through an on-air debate without killing each other. But maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. We are still working on a deep dive on education that's in the works, which is obviously very pertinent now that the Department of Education has once again entered the chat. I am going to do a deep dive on Joe Biden's last few days, weeks in office that went completely unreported by the legacy media. I'd like to get into that before we close the book on that incredibly regrettable chapter in American history. And there's other things we're working on too, trying to get back on schedule here, you know, slogging through the winter. It's just kind of a blah time of year for yours truly. I mean, it happens to me every year. We'll get through it. You know, thank you guys. Thank you all so much for listening. Please continue to like, subscribe, follow, share. I mean, I can't tell you guys this enough. Every click, every download, every listen, every share helps spread the word. And I really hope you're enjoying what you're hearing. You know, please send me suggestions on what you'd like what you'd like to hear us cover on the show. I've got a shiny new email address for the show, so you can email the show at JDSSS, that's three S's, JDSSSpodcast@gmail.com. That's JDSSS, spin sold separately, podcast@gmail.com. Please let me know what you'd like to hear about, what you'd like to talk about, you know, your thoughts on the show. Please be nice. I'm what Dan Cole, the common man, likes to call a snag, sensitive new age guy. I can handle criticism, but only when it's delivered in a Minnesota nice kind of way. Thank you all so much. Again, that email address is jdsspodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for your time. We're going to wrap here. This has been Spin Sold Separately. I am JD. Don't be a jerk. Insurance companies have the best marketing people. And I'll talk to you next time.